I'm Eason, it's Friday, and this is the Friday show. Pep Guardiola's bogey team are who we face tomorrow, Crystal Palace. Joining me to preview that, to look back at the week we've had, discuss Netflix, discuss Villa, discuss whatever else takes our fancy. I've got Lloyd, and firstly, I've got Ben. Afternoon, Ben.
Hi, Eason. How you doing?
Yeah, very good, sir. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. It's been a nice short week post-Easter. Games are coming thick and fast for City, and some unexpected drama in West London last night, which kept the week moving along.
Yeah, I went to bed pretty early, and I woke, whenever I wake up and there's like 16, 18 WhatsApp messages, then you know shenanigans happened in the late football, and yeah, then I had a look and I was like, oof, wow. Lloyd, did you watch it?
Of course, yeah. Was in a pub. Classic London, no more United fans in there than Chelsea. but I mean, I went for like a draw in my prediction, so I was like kind of willing that on a bit. But when Palmer scored that, what was it, 101st minute win against United, I did cheer, to be fair. you can't not. It's just United losing that game is so funny. They were so dominant, actually, in the last 15, 20 minutes. It honestly didn't look like Chelsea were going to score, and then they just did them twice. It's unbelievable.
You know what? Selfishly, I can't help but think that it's the perfect result because United did actually play well, and yet they still managed to lose, which means that they will be particularly up for it on Sunday. So I've definitely got my fingers crossed that that they defend a little better and are a little more focused and attacking sort of the same way. But I am clutching at straws, aren't I, Lloyd?
Don't tell me you're holding out hope for a result at the weekend.
Actually, you know what? I am. I mean, it's not even about holding out hope. Like, I don't think it's wildly unrealistic to expect that United could get something out of that game.
They're just so shit, though. I mean, they're defensively horrendous. I think if Liverpool turn up and play to like 80% of their capability, they'll win the game comfortably.
I wish football were that simple. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, I don't think it is. I watched a little bit of the Scousers against Sheffield United, and they kind of did what they've done for a lot of this season, which is just about get away with it, but there's been a lot of just about getting away with it for them. So I think if you focus on their results, it's definitely something that can make you a little bit nervous or make you think, oh wow, you know, they might win every single game. But if you've actually watched them for over the last few months, they've done a lot of getting away with it. So yeah, it'll be interesting. And anyway, it's at Old Trafford.
Have you just on United there, because I think we've got a laugh at United. Have you seen the two stats that have done the rounds post that game?
No.
About United. So in 2024, there's a table up to produce most shots conceded in the Premier League. United are top with 225, then Brentford, then Sheffield United, then West Ham, then Luton, then Burnley. Also, not only have United conceded the most shots in 2024 of any Premier League team, they've conceded the most shots of any team in Europe's top five leagues in 2024.
That's amazing.
That's insane. That is absolutely insane.
Mm.
Mm. They're so bad.
But this, you know, they're such a weird team. So they were 2-0, right? And then they get a goal back, right? And when they got the goal back, I watched the first half of the game, right? So when they got the goal back at 2-1, there's this moment where they cut to Ten Hag on the touchline, right? And you know, most managers, you watch them and they're telling their team to be compact, right? They're telling the team, get closer together, get compact. He's literally saying stretch. He's saying to the forward, stretch, go forward, and he's saying to the defenders, go back. That's mad. It's the most
clearly a tactic there, because it's how they've played in every game. They almost vacate the midfield
It's so mad.
Almost coach teams on to then try and defend them around the box. It's a crazy tactic. There's a reason people haven't used it before. It's mental.
It's also, I don't know if either of you caught for my sins, I caught like a trailer for the overlap, and Rio Ferdinand was on it this week, and it's getting to the point now, I think, where there's some of these external influences and pundits which are really ramping pressure up on Ten Hag, and they talked about that exact thing that you mentioned there, Lloyd, about basically space in front of the defence, and that's why this stat is around about conceding his most shots. And essentially, it was almost in line, to be honest, with Keane's comment about Haaland being a League Two striker. They were almost saying any manager worth their salt would see, you know, there's an issue here. We're conceding too many shots. Let's just, you know, whether it be sitting in an individual game or play more defensively. And I just think when those noises start to come from some of these pundits as well as, you know, as the fans and other people in the media, that's when, you know, there's another thing there, as well as the Ineos factor as well. To unfortunately for us, it's not be seeing Ten Hag sitting there as well next season. No.
And you know what the funny thing is? If you go back only like a week, 10 days, then you had Gary Neville basically giving it, well, you know, if you look at all the other managers that are out there and available, I think the best thing is to stick with Ten Hag. It's just they change their minds on a bi-weekly basis. But I think more importantly, I think it's a shame for us that he will go, because of all of the incompetent managers they've had in the last decade, Ten Hag's the most incompetent, I think, by some distance. I rate Solskjaer above Ten Hag. That's how bad I think Ten Hag is.
Moyes for me. Moyes is out there.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I can't even pick, you know.
You can't pick. You think they're all terrible.
They're all different shades of shite.
Yeah, they are. No, it's true. It's true. Right. That was a nice little 7-minute intro into this Friday show. Just pouring mirth on the rags. So, Ben, have you watched the City Netflix doc?
Yes, I finished watching it last night. I watched it. I missed the first. It was 2-2 when I tuned in to the United match. Then I finished watching the last two episodes last night.
So, what did you make of it?
So, I think if you were to be super cynical, I think it's obviously is a bit of a powder puff thing. But personally, as a fan, and I think, you know, there's a lot of fans that like this, is, you know, I'll hoover up any City content, to be honest. Anything remotely behind the scenes or anything which is going to get me some level of insight, whether that be Pep or the players or relationships with players. So from that point of view, you know, it was good watching. It was extra content. But I think watching it in its entirety, and obviously with the last episode, I think it did help me, like, personally reflect. Obviously with football being this cyclical thing whereby, you know, every August we start again and we start judging how we're doing, you know, on that very season, I still think that it helped me, you know, reflect on last season and just think how much of an achievement it was, how good the memories were, even though it's not that long ago. Some of those matches, you know, for the obviously the big ones that stick out, the Arsenal's, Real Madrid and Bayern Munich games. Just really, really happy watching and happy viewing. You know, makes you feel, you know, really, really good watching it, and I guess proud of what we achieved. And also, you know, I know it's been said on the pod before about how, you know, some of us are a little bit more chilled, I guess, about the outcome of this season. And I think it did that for me watching it last night. I sort of thought, you know, we've achieved so much winning that treble. And for us to still be in contention this season and still playing well. And also, you know, these players and managers, they're not robots. You know, it's not Football Manager or it's not FIFA where you just, you know, plug in and they go again. You know, there's obviously humans and human emotions and other factors that goes into being a successful team. As I say, I really enjoyed it overall. Thought it was great.
Lloyd, have we enjoyed the treble enough in its aftermath? Because I feel as though, to give that question a little bit of context, because obviously the run up to something like that, it's so intense, because you're effectively, you're playing in two cup finals and you know that you have to win them. So the build up is generally anxiety ridden, but then you come out the other side of it and the season's over and it's the summer and you busy yourself with the transfer window. And before you know it, the next season has begun and the treble has become a memory and we're all going, oh, it's such a terrible transfer window and oh, the squad isn't as strong and a couple of dodgy results. And by the end of the year, there's just, you know, there's a groundswell of negativity. And yet when I watched it, for me, the thing that really jumped out is like, I don't think we enjoyed it enough in its immediate aftermath.
I know what you mean. I think, in a way, though, that's kind of because of the nature of doing a treble. You have to. We went from Saturday, 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 from the final game of the season to the United FA Cup final to Istanbul, where you're almost ticking it off, and it's like right to Wembley, and then right to Istanbul, and you don't really reflect on what you've just done or the cup you've just won or the achievements. You're just thinking about the next one because there'd been so much talk about the treble. That being said, I definitely enjoyed it in the couple of nights after we were in Istanbul. A few very late nights, and you know, had a lot of fun there. But that's also the cyclical nature of football, isn't it? That as soon as something's definitely over, everyone's just thinking about the next thing. I think that's, in a way, though, the beauty of being able to watch this documentary and have something like that to kind of pour over, is that it reminds you of some of the little things you might have forgotten, and it does allow you to reflect on last season, not just what the players did, but personally you can think, oh, I was there watching that game, or oh, you know, I remember the game against Chelsea, or I remember the win against West Ham, etc. So that's, I think, what's really nice about it, because it is just really hard to kind of enjoy it in its fulsome at the exact time.
Definitely. I think what we'll do in the next couple of weeks is I'm going to do a pod on the actual Netflix documentary and just kind of maybe pick out four or five highlights over the six episodes that kind of give us a bit more of an insight into a player or into Pep or the setup at the club, because there's loads of little stuff that it's the kind of, for me, I'm fine with the idea of it being like a big PR exercise. It's produced in-house. It's kind of meant to be that. So you almost have to look in between the cracks to find the things that are actually meaningfully interesting. So yeah, we'll definitely do a pod and try and pick some of those bits out. Right. I want to start by looking backwards. And what I'd like to do actually is do Arsenal and Villa as kind of one thing. Ben, I'm going to start with you. Simple question to open with. Did you feel a point was fine against Arsenal, or did you feel it wasn't quite enough?
I thought it wasn't quite enough, being honest. I think when we looked at the fixtures with Arsenal and Liverpool, I felt that we needed to win one of them. And obviously there's not winning at Liverpool, and you can think, I think the second half sort of blurred that, really, is that, you know, you could argue that we should have potentially lost in the second half performance and how things played out. So after that, I sort of thought, right, now we really do need to beat Arsenal. And I think, as you've touched on a couple of times in the week, we were safe and we didn't really go for it. And it's one of those missed opportunity feelings. You know, all week, ever since, and, you know, it's one of those things, I think when I woke up the next day, it was the first thing that popped into my head, like, you know, we really could have done with that 3 points and effectively knocking Arsenal out of the top of the race, and I think, as Lloyd and I were talking briefly off air, is that the challenge now for us is, obviously, we've not been in this position where we essentially need two teams to drop points or to, you know, suffer a bit of indifferent form. And I feel that we could have, you know, taken Arsenal out there, really. So I didn't feel like a point was good enough. I wouldn't say I wrote us off. And, you know, again, watching the documentary when we're going into that run in and you sort of see that, you know, how far we were behind Arsenal, that also, you know, focused my mind a little bit that actually, you know, with 8 games remaining, it's still, you know, very much a possibility. You know, I wouldn't, and, you know, lots of people still put us as the favourite. So that helped, I guess, come to my realisation that it's not done. But yeah, certainly my immediate response was disappointment with the point.
Lloyd, when you look across the performance against Arsenal, how much of it is down to the selection, and how much of it do you think is down to a kind of, I don't know, like a kind of timidness based on the size of the game, if that makes sense?
I don't think much of it's down to the latter, really. I think City have enough big game experience, and we've monstered enough big and, you know, quite frankly, better teams than that Arsenal team before. I think a lot of it's down to A, the approach that we went for, but B, I just think, you know, some players and the team as a whole probably isn't just playing to the same level as it was last season. And I think a lot of that is down to the fact that certain key guys have either gone, in Gundo being the main one, or they're just not in the same kind of hit spot as they were last season. So, you know, Grealish in particular, but I thought his performance against Villa was very encouraging. You know, the defence was a bit done in terms of injuries, wasn't it? But, you know, Kev really didn't play his best game against Arsenal. Haaland, obviously, I thought he did okay, actually, and got too much stick. But, you know, he wasn't a massive threat in the game, was he, either? Bernardo, I thought, skinned Kivior nicely a few times where we were lacking a bit of end product. Phil looked really tired in that game. So, yeah, I think in the key areas, which was basically the final third, because that game was played in the final third, we probably didn't have enough difference makers early doors. And then I just don't think some of the guys that were trusted in that game were at their absolute best, which, when you come up against a team as defensively as strong as Arsenal, when they play so kind of reductively, it is tough to break them down.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's kind of the perfect segue into Villa. Lloyd, I'm going to stay with you. So, obviously, the Villa performance is a very different performance. Now, Villa are a different team to Arsenal, but for me, they attempted to be as negative as Arsenal were. So I guess that the big headlines are he took KDB and he took Haaland out of the team, and he played Foden, Grealish and Doku in behind Alvarez, and then Rico Lewis at right back. Is there an argument that, or this is a question, is it possible that maybe at times Pep can be a little too loyal to his kind of trusted old guard, and the performance in midweek is maybe a little bit of a signpost that there's lads chomping at the bit in the squad wanting to make an impression?
100%. I think Lewis's two performances when he's come in have really shown that he's ready to play at this level. Now, I do think he has his weaknesses, and I think you saw at points in that Villa game what the downsides are of playing Lewis in that kind of right back role, i.e. not having someone like Walker in that kind of wide area. It's really easy to break on us, and there were a few times that we did get counter-attacked on, and it happened second half against Arsenal. But the other side of the coin is he added so much, I think, to our general play and the ability just to rotate the ball quickly that I think it's a real option that's definitely not been used this season. I also think Bob's not been played enough this season for me in terms of how what he's shown, and then against the level of some of the other guys, the more senior guys that have been in the team. So yeah, I do think Pep sometimes can hold those players back, but I think it's down to hierarchy, isn't it? And he's been very consistent with that his entire time.
Well,
at City.
Well, I mean, yeah. As long as your name's not Julian Alvarez, he's been very consistent within that hierarchy. Alvarez is definitely the one player who has managed to leapfrog whatever the hierarchy was in the squad.
Yeah, but he's, I think when you're a signing, it's always a little bit different to when you're like a youth player that's come through. It's a bit hard. I think Pep definitely holds them on a little bit longer than the reverse. I think the thing that really stood out to me, though, because I tweeted, I thought that kind of selection and setup saw, I think, some of the best football we've seen this season. And a lot of people were like, well, basically, you're saying that's because Haaland didn't play. And actually, it wasn't necessarily that. I thought having Lewis, Bernardo and Rodri all centrally, being able to ping the ball off each other, little 2-5 yard passes, it made such a difference. Villa literally didn't know where the ball was. I thought one of the big problems against Arsenal was that we were so congested and they were obviously so tight into us. Often, actually, one that was getting choked up a bit on the ball and just wasn't able to play those little balls around the corner. And when you see Phil, Bernardo, Rodri and Lewis doing it, they're all so good at that little tight spaces thing. It made it incredibly difficult for Villa. And it actually meant that Alvarez actually got a lot of space in behind because you pulled players all round and Alvarez, you know, he had three chances, didn't he, where he kind of peeled off the back, and Haaland would have loved that. So I don't necessarily think it's a Haaland thing, like some people said. So no, really good signs out of Villa. And I think, it's only a good thing now that we're going into Palace and there's a genuine conversation about whether two of our best players like deserve to play or should play that game.
Ben, where do you land on the KDB Foden conversation insofar as I think that there's I've the feeling that outside of the City bubble, a lot of people are beginning to say, you know, we're witnessing the passing of the baton from Kevin De Bruyne to Phil Foden, and Phil Foden is quite clearly the natural successor to Kev.
I think it was you, Ason, that I said when we got to a point with Foden that once he was breaking into the team, is that Pep would have found it hard to essentially pull him out of the team. And I feel like now we're getting to the point where if he was, you know, basically he's too good in that central position to take him out. And I think the thing with Kev is that obviously he's had a stop-start season. You know, if we were to cast our minds back sort of 6 weeks, 2 months when he first came back, and we were all absolutely drooling over him. And I think some people have kind of forgotten that a little bit about how good he was when he first came back and how he did look head and shoulders above not just all of our players, but in the league. So I'm not at the point yet where, you know, Kev should be, you know, for example, on the bench. I just feel that we have to get them both involved centrally. In terms of passing the torch, obviously that's a natural thing, but I think Kev, the player that he is, the intelligence that he has, I don't think he needs to be in that, you know, 8 or in that 10. I think he's the sort of player that wherever he's going to play, you know, I think it was the Arsenal game where at times it was almost like Bernardo and Kev were out on the wings and he was trying to get Foden in the middle. And I think it obviously didn't work, you know, well in that game in terms of we were too defensive. But I think finding something that will work with that in mind and getting all of our best players on the pitch, obviously, which Foden and Kev are, is the way, you know, that we can stand a chance of winning something or, you know, or winning the league this season.
Just to play devil's advocate for a minute, Ben, is it really a case of trying to get our best players on the pitch? Wouldn't Wednesday suggest that actually getting the best balance on the pitch is the right route forward?
I mean, the obvious answer is it's a bit of both, I think. And I think the what I really liked about the match in the week was, you know, and Lloyd said there about with Rodri and Enrico and Bernardo in there, but I'd also say Foden and Alvarez were just as involved in that. You know, what I would call is almost like that ratting of, you know, chasing everything down. That's where, you know, Foden's third goal comes from. And I think what we need in there and what we're sometimes in danger of, and we saw this, you know, in previous seasons, I remember people sort of saying this about when Rodri and Gundo played together, was not having enough dynamism, and I think that's where we landed a little bit with Arsenal. Is that with Kovacic, who, you know, I like and he's good, but it does almost become, you know, if you've got him sitting in and Rodri, and, you know, and Kev isn't running around as much as the likes of Foden and even Alvarez does, to be honest, is things start to become slow. And I, what I liked about Wednesday was we had that tenacity in midfield, but we also had the ability, and as Lloyd said, we, those lovely like 1-2 touch triangles that we played to get ourselves out of trouble was great, but we also had the option of, you know, Grealish and Doku hugging the touchline, being out there for that. And it happened a number of times, that 30, 40-yard switch, played it out, spreads it. So it's a nice mix of the two, whereas Arsenal almost felt like we were just playing within the width of the penalty boxes, really. We weren't stretching Arsenal enough. I mean, Arsenal played really well, but they only had to defend the width of their penalty box. We didn't sort of, you know, we didn't ask enough questions, I guess.
Lloyd, if you remember in the build-up to Arsenal when the team sheet drops, there was very much the sense of that's the team everybody wants. In many ways, it was the team that everybody had been asking for a while now. And there was quite heavy critique around Doku, around Grealish, around the idea of control and how much control we do or don't have in certain games. Do you think that the quick contrast between Arsenal and Villa, it maybe begins to tell us why Pep has lent a little bit more in the chaos ball direction at times this season?
Quite possibly. Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of games, hasn't there, when we've had Alvarez starting over generally been Kovacic, hasn't it? And a lot of the fans have been like, what are we doing? Particularly when, I think more so when like Kevin Foden were both back in the team and you see Alvarez is playing centrally in certain games, you're just a bit like, this doesn't seem to make that much sense. But, you know, I can't be a hypocrite. I did like that team against Arsenal. I think Pep should have changed it earlier, like I said on the review. But
would you pick it again? Not in that game, but what I mean is, so for example, Real Madrid on Tuesday, would you have any concerns if you picked that team against Madrid on Tuesday?
Well, I think other players are available now that weren't. So for example, I think if Grealish is fit, then Madrid away is almost the perfect game. I think you want to play Jack Grealish in that game. So, I mean, my team for Madrid would be, I think it'd be probably most people's team, which would be, you know, Akanji, Stones if he can play, Diaz, Kvaratskhelia, and then Rodri, Bernardo, and Foden, and then Kev, Grealish, and Haaland up front. That would be what I would go for. So I appreciate that, you know, there's definitely an advantage to having someone like Kovacic, but I think when everyone's available, City's best 11 players is those players. And the team that we saw away at Copenhagen, I think, was the first time almost this season that we kind of saw that front six. So I expect that would be the team if, you know, if everyone's in good nick.
I don't think we need Kovacic when we've got Stones or Lewis on the pitch, to be honest. As good as he is, and as I said, he's played well in parts this season, I just don't think we need it. I think Rodri has got enough support, whether it's Rico Lewis or Stones with him, I think. And that, again, just puts us as another attacking player on the pitch, which is what we liked against Arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm a little bit wary of the idea that you've got Grealish and Bernardo on the two wings. I think that is...
Well, he's probably playing Foden on the right wing, isn't he? Realistically.
Yeah, but I mean, rather than what Pep is going to do, I'm having more of a conversation about what I think would work and what I think won't work. And I think that to a greater or a lesser extent, it's very difficult to see how, like, I find it really hard to believe that he moves Foden to the right wing against Palace or against Madrid. And I think that if Pep does that, then he has to get the result. Because if he doesn't get the result, he'll get hammered. Because Phil, by some distance, has been our best attacking player this season. And he's done 90% of his best attacking work centrally. I think that it's no coincidence that if you look at the games that he maybe hasn't excelled in, they're games in which he has been marooned out on a wing and somebody else has played centrally. So, and again, like, you know, I'll throw this over to you, Ben. It's money time in the season. Every game is a cup final. Every game is a big game. There's surely some validity in playing players in the positions that they're excelling in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as I said earlier, I think to take Foden, you know, he's played in the middle in the week. He's got a hat trick. He played in the middle against Brentford. He got a hat trick. It just feels like it'd be criminal, really. And I think to hit back on your point a little bit about with Bernardo and Grealish being out on the wings, I get that they're not, you know, they are more, you know, possession wingers or whatever the term would be. But what that does give you then is potentially gives you Foden and Kev in the middle. And it's a different way of doing things rather than having flying wingers that may cough up the ball. And I think that's where, particularly with Doku, is that the risk, and, you know, Pep's always playing this risk game, is that might secure with him that, you know, we're going to keep the ball where we can, but equally the ones with a bit more jeopardy are the ones which are going to be closer to the goal and have more chance of having an impact around there.
I think that's a fair shout. I guess that I'm a little bit cynical about the idea that Foden ends up centrally. I think that if he picks that collection of players, I fear that Guardiola's natural instincts will be to tuck Bernardo inside and stick Kev out on the wing. And I mean, look, you see that when we play with Haaland, generally, it's a little bit of a 4-4-2 insofar as certainly off the ball, you have Haaland and KDB that are the furthest forward. And when KDB's not on the pitch, you have Haaland and Foden as the two of the that are the furthest forward. And so it's, for me, I almost feel as though we've reached a point where I'd like to see Phil's position almost be immovable, and then the rest of the team and all the other players are built around Phil's position, because I think that he is good enough and capable enough of playing in that position in a responsible fashion. Because I think that's the cliche, is that, you know, Foden's only got one gear, and when he gets the ball, he just wants to go forward. And, you know, the implication underneath it is that he's not smart enough, right, to know when to go and when to stay. And I don't agree with that.
Well, he's shown this season that that's not the case. He's developed his game, and the fact that Pep's continually picked him in the middle shows that he believes that too. So I think that debate is over.
Okay. So last thing on the Villa game, kind of taking a broad view of it, how much of that performance is down to how weakened Villa were and how much of it was down to City?
Well, I mean, I'd say like most things, it's a bit of both, but I'd put it more down to City playing well than Villa. So Villa obviously had Watkins, McGinn and Kamara missing, who are three massive players for them. And obviously Martinez, the goalie, kind of pulled out in the warm-up, didn't he? I think he was on the team to start and then didn't.
Mm.
But Olsen played well. I thought that save from Alvarez was a top save, to be fair. But yes, they were kind of without their best team, and it wasn't the team, say, that faced us in December when they just completely monstered us in midfield. But that being said, it was still a pretty strong side, and really a lot of what was good about that performance was just the intensity with which we played at, and the kind of rotations in attack and the way that we sustained attacks. We were knackering Villa out, that's something we've not just seen as much this season as we have last. So I'd be minded to give more City more credit than putting it all on Villa's absences personally.
Dan, would you go along with that?
Yeah, I think we often say on the podcast about how you can tell early doors how a game's going to play out or how City are set. And I think that first 10, 15 minutes, we just looked bang up for it. And there was also the other spell, which said that to me, was after we scored the second goal before half time. We could have scored about another three goals before half time. We were just all over them, high pace, but with that sustained control. And as I touched on earlier, as soon as we lost the ball, three, four players around that, the Villa players getting it back. So I think it's always difficult to you know, think how it would have changed and how it would have been different. They also had Tielemans, who's a big player for them, I think, on the bench, and you know how things would have worked out differently. But it almost feels
Paul Torres as well.
Yeah, they didn't get a chance really to get started, and it sort of felt like one of those performances that we would just bang up for it, and whoever was in front of us, we'd have beaten them.
Okay, excellent. Well, I think that's a very nice segue into the game that we're previewing, the lunchtime kickoff tomorrow, City away at Palace. Lloyd, do you want to have a word on the scheduling? Palace early kickoff and then Real Madrid on the Tuesday?
That's a joke, isn't it? Particularly after playing on Wednesday.
Mm.
And then playing, obviously we played the last game of the weekend against Arsenal on the Sunday as well. So Pep's got to do what he's got to do, hasn't he? I think you saw that with the team selection a little bit. Midweek, I think he'll have to rotate again against Palace. And I agree with you on the review from Villa. I think there's a chance that one of Haaland or De Bruyne probably don't start this game as well. I'd imagine maybe De Bruyne sits out again. So it's a fucking joke, but what can we do?
Would you rest Haaland? I'm going to ask you both this, so I'll start with you, Lloyd, right? So I'm giving you the keys to the team selection. Would you rest Haaland and KDB?
I would not rest Haaland. I didn't love Haaland not playing midweek because I just feel like he needs to play to get himself into form. He needs to get in front of goal and start getting chances. With the big games coming up, we need him to make the difference. And if we're being brutally honest, he hasn't made the difference in enough of the big games this season. And I think the best opportunity for him to do that is to get him in front of goal, get his confidence up and score a couple. So I'd be a bit nervous about him going straight into Madrid away if he hasn't played the last two games. So I'd absolutely start him 100%. And he has to do way less running than most of the other players anyway. I think he generally covers about 5 to 6K a game, as opposed to like 10 plus for the midfielders. So I'd 100% start Erling against Palace.
Ben, what about for you? Erling and KDB, are you resting either of them or both of them for Madrid?
I'd start them both for this game, to be honest. I think particularly Kev is all about rhythm. He's said that before, that he likes to play every 3 days. Obviously, you know, he's had a fragmented season and we've tried to be careful with him. But I think now, this point in the season, you know, players can get injured at any point, whether it's training or anything. Obviously, there's a higher chance for matches, but I think we've given them, he's looked at these three games, you know, he's probably looked at load across all of the squad and all of the players and essentially said, you know, right, by missing that game entirely for the likes of Stones, Kev and Haaland, essentially that means that they can play the next two games. And I think that's what he'll go with. I think we'll be strong on Saturday and all three of those will play.
Do you think that it was interesting, I was listening to Marcotti and Julian Laurens on the ESPN pod yesterday, and they were both saying that they expect the Palace team to be the Madrid team.
Yeah, I could see that. Potentially some rotation at the back. Like, I think personally, I think Lewis was so good on Wednesday, I sort of think that he deserves to keep his place. So I could maybe see either a Kanji, or who again I think has been excellent recently, either a Kanji or Diaz dropping out and Lewis keeping his place at right back. But yeah, I think it'll be a strong team, maybe one player difference between what we face Madrid with.
That's what they said. I think in my head, I kind of went, I can see that insofar as Stones is the one that you absolutely ain't risking. Like, if John Stones turns up on Saturday and goes, I'm fully fit, I want to play today, I'd be going, sit down. You can play on Tuesday against Madrid. Lloyd, I think the best way to have the conversation about Palace is really to have the conversation about Palace and Madrid. So firstly, do you go along with Ben that you can see a world in which the team is more or less the Madrid team?
No, I think there'll be a couple of changes probably because of the scheduling.
Okay.
So I think there'll probably be one in defence and then one in kind of midfield attack that'll be different. I think there's a chance he rests Foden, actually.
Mm.
I think he's played a lot of football. He's in great form. He doesn't really need the Palace game. I think there's a chance Phil sits out and it's Kev centrally with, you know, whoever. Take your pick from Bernardo or Kovacic. And then I could see it being Grealish and Doku again. And then Haaland up front. I could definitely see that. And I think Lewis keeps his place. I think he has to play after how well he's done. And I would imagine Pep probably wants to bring Stones on for like 20, 25 minutes at the end just to see if he can get through that with an idea of obviously starting him away at Madrid if he's okay. So yeah, I think those would probably be the only changes I could foresee, really. So yeah, maybe someone like Kovacic comes in if he wants to rest Bernardo and then play with the two wingers. Because realistically now, I don't know if people have been following Palace that much, but I follow them pretty closely. They've switched to a back five under Glasner, so they play differently to how they did under Roy. So I think those wide areas are going to be really important. And Doku, to me, is someone that could be really key, I think, at Selhurst.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing with Doku and with Grealish is that they both played so well against Villa in different ways that you almost want them both to play again against Palace in exactly the same positions, in exactly the same way, to get enough rhythm in there. Like, my ideal is Guardiola having headaches for the Real Madrid team. So my ideal is we play Palace and Doku and Grealish are absolutely unbelievable and unplayable. And it puts Pep in a position where he's like, ah, okay, I really have decisions to make about Madrid. I think this is going to end up being probably the most difficult conversation to have, and that is Ortega and Edison. So Pep's just confirmed that Edison will be back in the squad for Palace. So Ben, firstly, how has Ortega done in Edison's absence? Where do you land on the competition for places versus you have a number one keeper? And how are you dealing with Palace and Madrid from a goalkeeper point of view?
So in terms of how Ortega has fared whilst Edison's been out, I literally don't think you could ask any more of your second keeper. He's come in that Liverpool game, obviously high-pressure game, didn't put a foot wrong when he came in. You know, we didn't miss a beat with regards to how Edison played versus how Ortega can play. So I really think he's been excellent. And we saw against Villa, his distribution was good, like it always is. I think it's still at, you know, a level down, but we all know that, you know, Edison is the best there is from that point of view. But he was also great at doing other things, such as, you know, he came out for a couple of crosses, and that's huge. And it's also huge in big games. So I think, you know, really happy with him, sure, Pep is. And, you know, I'd certainly be one that'd be giving him a big fat contract and the highest paid second goalkeeper in the world, because he's that important and it's that important to us. In terms of where I sit in terms of having a number one, I think you have to have a number one. And I think, with the caveat that, you know, nobody's place is secure in a squad, I sort of think that with the keeper, it has to be that way. Unless, obviously, they're going through some absolutely dreadful form. But I think you have to have the number one, both from the keeper's point of view, but also, I feel, from the defence's point of view. And obviously, our defenders are all top-class players, the majority of them great with the ball. But you do notice, particularly, you know, when Ortega's come in the odd cup game, you'll see really small things such as, you know, they're used to playing it back to Edison on his left foot versus Ortega on his right. And there's those, you know, those fine margins that we're aware that Pep works on, that, you know, that's why I think to be swapping and changing people. And also it puts, you know, high pressure on those individuals, in that they know, you know, they might only play in two or three games and the odd mistake and it's swapping and changes. And I don't think it's good for anybody. So for me, if Edison's fit versus Palace and he plays against Madrid, that's what I'd go with.
Lloyd, I would like to know what you think.
Well, in the spirit of good podcasting, I completely disagree, actually. I'm with Ben, but I think you have to have a number one. I don't love the way that Arteta sold it with Ramsdale and Raya, or that De Zerbi runs it with the two goalies at Brighton. But I think that being said, you have to be able to adapt. And I think Ortega's been so good. I don't think you can drop him. I think he's literally been pretty much faultless. I'd start him against Palace because it sounds like Edison should be involved, but maybe won't be able to play. Pep's just said maybe he'll be in the squad, direct quote. I think if he plays against Palace, I think he's got to play against Madrid. So I would play Ortega in both games. I think he's been that good. And I think with the contract situation as well, I think he should play.
Yeah, I'm with you. I agree with Ben insofar as I don't think you can have you need a number one goalkeeper. But you also have to be cognizant of form and fitness and also just general squad motivation. And I think that if somebody like Ortega comes in because Edison's injured and he plays at a ridiculous level, as he has done in my opinion, then I think it's criminal to then take him out of the team until he makes a mistake. And I know that the upshot of that could be that Ortega ends up playing every game between now and the end of the season, but then so be it. I think, you know, I've often admired Pep for saying, you know, when players come to me and they complain about not being in the side, I always say to them, you have to show it to me on the grass. You have to go out there and perform. And I think that the other side of that coin is that when players do that, they have to be able to feel that they're going to keep their shirt. And I think that applies to the goalkeeper as much as it does to the centre half or the right back in this instance. And I think the other thing, and this is maybe a little bit where a distinction would come in for me. I think there's a difference between, for example, Rico Lewis at 18 coming in and playing out of his skin, deputizing for Walker or for Akanji, and Ortega coming in for Edison. Lewis is still a kid, and I understand with kids there will be moments or games where you go, you know what, I'm just not putting him in there, even though he's been playing out of his skin for a month, simply because you don't want him to feel. I think with defenders and with the goalkeeper, it's always that thing, you make one mistake and you've given a goal up, right? And how is that then going to affect the next 6 months of your career? Because it can have that kind of catastrophic effect if you stick Lewis in at right back in Madrid and Vinicius skins him twice and they win 2-0. That's something that it's very, very, very difficult to come back from, bounce back from quickly. And I don't think you want to do that to young kids. Ortega's different. He's a grown man, you know, he's been a professional for years. And so I think that he should be given and afforded that opportunity, certainly in these two games. Sorry, Lloyd, you were going to say something.
No, I agree. Ortega's 31, so you know he's hardly a kid. He's an experienced pro, like you said. I think even without the contract situation, I think he still deserves to play anyway. I think that just moves the needle a bit. But he's been amazing, and I wouldn't be against the idea next season, for example, of. If part of the reason to convince him to stay is, right, you play Champions League and Edison plays Premier League, I'd be absolutely fine with that. And I think they'd be better suited to those competitions as well. So I hope they're exploring some sort of unique deal, because I think for me, this Ortega situation, it's giving me just Gundogan 2.0, to be honest, if the club don't try and resolve it. I think you can have all these kind of rules that you want about wage structures for second goalies, or in Gundogan's case, not giving two-year deals to 32-year-olds. You've got to adapt. Sometimes things happen and you've got to react accordingly. If that guy walks out the door, nailed on, you won't replace him with a better goalkeeper. and City should be trying to do everything they can to keep Edison's arse, you know, a bit nervy as well. So yeah, I'd be thinking about something like that for next season.
Ben, would you like to have the right to reply?
I think that Champions League option, you know, if doing something like that, I think that sounds good. But yeah, I mean, I'd argue that Edison is out of the team because of an injury. There's not, you know, although there's been a couple of moments this season, he's not made huge glaring mistakes, I don't think. But yeah, I mean, the caveat, you know, it's not a bad position to be in, isn't it? Is that, you know, if for example, Pep was to do as you both say, you know, I'd have absolutely no problem with that. I wouldn't be worried seeing Ortega in the lineup. I think he's more than capable to be our first choice keeper. For me, Edison's just that little bit ahead with his feet. There's a couple of times where I still get a little bit nervous with Ortega. I'm a bit more nervous with Ortega than I am Edison. So for me, that's why.
But you can't. I'm calmer on Ortega for a one-on-one than I am for Edison.
One-on-one, yeah. I think from a one-on-one, and you know, maybe we could extend that to penalties as well, considering Edison doesn't get near them as well. But I think with his feet, there's still a couple of times I think where it's only ever so slight. But Ortega, maybe he has it with his feet a little bit longer than Edison. I just think Edison's is that level above.
Yeah, Edison's the best in the world with his feet. I don't think anyone is close to touching him. But Ortega, I don't think is an enormous drop off. And I would say he's a slightly better shot stopper. So
yeah,
there is a bit of quid pro quo, I think, on each side there.
Yeah.
Problems.
Yeah, they are in a way they are good problems. All right, look, I want to begin to bring this around to a starting 11 for Palace. Just one thing that's come out of their press conference is Glasner has said that Elise will only be fit to play maybe 15 or 20 minutes against City. That's what the medical staff have told him.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely.
He's unbelievable. He's so good.
He is, and also it's just one of them. I definitely don't need a worldie from Elise settling any kind of result on Saturday at lunchtime. But yeah, Ben, I'm going to start with you. What team are you picking for Palace? So Pep says that Ake and Walker are definitely not fit and are still unavailable.
Okay, so on the basis of what we just said, with Edison being fit, I'd be starting Edison. I'd have Rico Lewis, Stones, Kanji, and Gvardiol across the back. And then I would have Rodri. And then ahead of that, I would have KDB, Doku, Foden, and Grealish behind Haaland. And I'd rest Bernardo for this one.
Okay. Lloyd?
So I would go, I'd have Edison out. I'd have Stones on the bench. So I'd play Ortega, Lewis, Akanji, Diaz, Gvardiol. So same back five that played against Villa. Rodri, obviously. And then I would play either Kovacic or Bernardo, kind of alongside Rodri. And then I'd play KDB with Doku and Grealish. And I'd play Haaland. I'd give Foden a rest.
Interesting. Okay. I would pick Ortega, Lewis, Akanji, Diaz, Gvardiol, Rodri, Foden and KDB as eights, Doku on the right, Grealish on the left, and Haaland up top. I'd basically go more or less all out attack, and be hoping that the two wide men continue their form from midweek, be hoping that the balance between KDB and Foden in a game like this where you're playing against a back five helps to open them up faster. And then kind of, you know, you almost, I feel as though you want to take the momentum from Villa in Palace, because then you could take that into Real Madrid. Right. Ben, give me a score prediction.
I'm going to go 2-0 professional performance away from home.
Lovely. Lloyd, give me a prediction.
It's Selhurst. I'm going. We usually get over the line, but it's tight. I think it could be what it was last season. I think it could be 1-0.
Interesting.
Like a grubby 1-0.
So I am going to go 3-0 City. I think I think we about to hit that point in the season that we hit around this time last season, where we get very good, very strong, very tough. Right. Lovely. That was the Friday show. Ben, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Actually, is there anything else you want to discuss, either of you, before I wrap this up?
Not for me.
Lloyd, no, Ortega Edison was the main one for me.
Okay, fine. Well, we've covered it then. So, Lloyd, thank you very much.
Cheers, mate. Have a good weekend.
To everybody who listened, thank you very much. This was the Friday show on the 9320 podcast. Howard Hawkins should be bringing, fingers crossed, a special a little bit later with a very special Crystal Palace fan. In the meantime, be safe, be well, and as always, up the Blues.